This is the Soul Center Fitness Podcast with Stephen Slack, and today we have Dr. Jared Spencer, a sports psychologist, author of Mind of the Athlete, A Clearer Mind, Better Performance, and also he does some sports psychology for professional athletes, college athletes, high school athletes, etc. I'm really excited, as I always say, about this conversation, but more importantly, he's got such a rich background into the mind, hate to use a pun, mind of the athlete, that I'm very interested to dive into different topics about athletes, but also about everyday workers, everyday adults, and the differences, and what he thinks is the most important thing maybe plaguing our time right now, stealing our motivation. So without further delay, let's get this party started. Hey guys, this is Stephen Slack, and today I've got a great special guest. I'm very excited to talk with Jared. He's going to give us a little bit of background to start off, and then also talk about his organization that he has as well. So without further delay, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. Yes. Pleasure to be with you guys. Yep. I'm Dr. Jared Spencer, sports psychologist, author of the book Mind of the Athlete, Clear Mind, Better Performance. And I'm really passionate about improving the emotional health of athletes.
Oh, awesome. Cool. Now, what is, I was looking into it a little bit.
Sure.
What is some of the history? I saw that you were a wrestler in
sure.
high school.
Okay. Grew up in Phillipsburg, New Jersey.
Okay.
I was a high school wrestler and football player.
Oh, cool.
And learned had a lot of these amazing highs and amazing lows.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you're the hero, sometimes you're the goat. And I was that. And then I went to Lafayette College, right across the bridge in Easton, Pennsylvania, where yep. I was a tailback on the football team and then also continued to wrestle as well. And so I had a lot of experience in sports through my time at Lafayette as well.
That's awesome. So do you feel like back then, I know right now you're a sports psychologist, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the primary thing you're doing?
Yes.
Yeah.
90% of the work I do is sports psychology. Outside of that, I'll also work with some corporations, companies,
okay.
where some former athletes who are now CEOs or presidents of the companies bring me in to share the same kind of content with their staff.
Okay, cool. And yeah. and do you feel like back then, I'm talking now back in your high school
yeah.
and college, did you feel like you knew you were going to be a sports psychologist?
No, I didn't. In fact, the concept didn't even exist.
Okay.
So when I was playing sports in the 90s, like the idea of a sports psychologist really wasn't out there.
Oh, okay.
I just knew that I was fascinated by the mind-body. And in particular, on my high school graduation, a mentor of mine, Ivan Boyesen, gave me a book called The Way of the Peaceful Warrior.
Okay, that sounds pretty epic.
It's amazing, by Dan Millman.
Okay.
And it was a story about a college gymnast who was injured. He has to come back, but he meets a mentor who teaches him that it's more about the mental than the physical.
Okay.
And once I read that book, I was hooked, and I realized, like, oh my gosh, there's so much more about the mind that I literally made up a major at Lafayette College called psychobiology.
Okay.
Went to my advisor and we created this because I was interested in the mind-body connection and particularly like how it could lead to human thriving and not just surviving. And so once I made up that major of psychobiology, which is now called neuroscience at Lafayette,
oh,
actually
okay.
made it official major. Neuroscience. I pursued a doctorate in health psychology because I've always and still am intrigued by the capacity, the capabilities within our minds.
That's pretty awesome. With that said, I want to touch on neuroscience real quick
sure.
and just kind of take a little audible
yeah,
here
good.
At the line. But so with the neuroscience side, obviously there's a strong scientific background to that.
Right.
It has science in its name. So it's not just talking about thoughts, talking about mentality. There's
no.
a little bit of biology involved in it.
A lot of biology.
Okay.
And the reason is because an athlete today wants to understand the why.
Yeah.
If you say to somebody, well, you should take a couple deep breaths before you compete, that's not going to do it. But if you explain the whole physiological process of how breathing in more oxygen is going to increase blood flow and muscle contraction in the fingertip. Like, okay, when I understand that whole complicated chain, now I'll do the breathing. They want to know the physiology. So as a sports psychologist, I have to be well-versed in neuroscience and physiology, because that is going to give the validation to the technique.
Okay. So it's, if you just kind of say, okay, you know, take three deep breaths, it's kind of like pie in the sky. Like,
you got
what
it.
He's just kind of giving me some mumbo jumbo.
You got it.
But now if you actually say, this is scientifically what's happening.
Yes.
Now they can actually connect to it. And it's funny, because I know in school, when I was in school, it was hard for me to learn certain topics unless I knew the reason, like, you know, the whole structure of what was going on. And until I knew that, then I couldn't connect the dots to certain things.
We want to know why.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, talking now back about Mind of the Athlete, what is this organization? How did it start? Kind of give us background into that.
Sure. When I started out as a health psychologist, my postdoctoral fellowship, I was working in a hospital a bit and private practice, and I was sharing the same concepts, but the goal was really to get people like feeling better out of the hospital and, you know, alleviation of symptoms. But at the same time, I remember I had a couple of local wrestlers, and I'd share the same kind of cognitive behavioral techniques, and they'd go out and compete that weekend and have success. I read about it in the newspaper. Okay. They'd come back and they say, give me some more. And I would. And I just found, like, boy, it's so much more fun for me to share this stuff with people that are at that age, you know, 15 to 25, where the clay is pretty moldable, I like to say, that they're going to take this and then apply it in, like, a pretty intense laboratory every weekend.
Yeah.
And so I just found so much more enjoyment in seeing people flourish and get theirs and have success, or maybe even get into a college that was better than they thought, or maybe get a little money for that scholarship. And that's continued now where I work with high school, college, and professional athletes. And
that's awesome.
And really trying to help everyone at the highest levels find the capability inside of themselves by managing their emotions better.
Yeah, it's the one point that you touched on in that was that you liked that certain age group.
Yes.
And it kind of interestingly enough, I know that when I worked at Parisi Speed School, they were saying a lot of times like, hey, we love these ages because we're actually making pretty big changes in a athlete's life. We don't know if they're going to be a professional athlete or not. Sure. Most likely not.
Right.
But we're making huge changes in their life. Mm-hmm. Where I guess in more of the professional athletes, there's obviously a lot still can be worked on.
Sure.
But there's also been a lot of groundwork already set.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, in professional athletics, it's a whole different animal. Each of those levels are beyond what people might imagine. Okay. For example, if freshmen in college, they're just trying to adapt and manage frustration and, for the first time in life, disappointment that they're not the man or the woman.
Not the big fish in the pond.
Right. And then you can have a professional athlete who might be 28 years old and their confidence is very low because they see the younger guys coming up.
Yeah.
And they themselves are just trying to get one more contract, one more deal, a little bit more money. They're not ready to be done. And so they're struggling. And so each stage along the journey, no matter where you're at, there's a sports psychology a challenge that's developmentally in sync with that step.
Did it take a long time to kind of get all that knowledge? Because that's it seems like a lot of experiential knowledge that has to be.
Well, you know, they say wisdom is really healed pain.
Okay.
Healed pain. So a lot of what I have is my own healed pain.
Okay.
But also the wisdom is also from helping others heal their pain. So once I've walked with an individual on a journey, and we've taken that deep dive into the emotionality of what they've gone through, the good, the bad, the ugly, I'm able to help the others that follow because I've heard and helped in that place before.
That's pretty cool.
It's really cool.
I want to kind of step on another topic here. Now, we've been talking about athletes already, but more specifically, what is the most important thing you think an athlete needs. And I just talking to you before, sure. Now I realize there's a lot of different things with different ages. Yeah. Maybe let's pick the earlier ages.
Sure. So let me say it this way.
Yeah.
Mental health of athletes is unlike anything we've seen right now. Anxiety is off the chart.
Okay.
The research is very clear. But if I want to really help the mental health of athletes, I first have to help the sleep of athletes.
Okay. Huh.
Because sleep is the number one factor in performance, yet we know that the college athlete on average is getting 6.5 hours of sleep, not much different for our high school athlete. So we can't solve mental health, anxiety management, for example, if we can't first get them sleeping more hours and improving their sleep. Now, that being said, we cannot solve the sleep problem in America today until we solve the underlying reason why people are sleeping less, which is cell phone addiction in America today.
Okay, so we're blaming the cell phone. Okay.
90% of the people that I poll lie in bed at night looking at their phone before they fall asleep. Now, the problem is the blue light of the phone suppresses melatonin, which is a chemical we need to fall asleep.
Okay, yeah.
So every night we're giving ourselves a dose of anti-melatonin at the exact time the brain's trying to release melatonin. So what ends up happening is we miss that window that we'd ideally fall asleep. There's a specific time you'd ideally fall asleep every night. And then we get our second wind, and now we're up.
Yeah.
In addition to that, research is very clear. The more time you're on social media, the more depressed we actually feel.
Huh.
So we're giving ourselves a dose of depression and anti-sleep every night.
That's pretty a good concoction right there.
Unbelievable. And then we wonder why mental health is on the rise. But the solution seems simple. We'll just get the cell phone out of bed.
Yeah.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. It seems like, then the root issue is there that some habits have been formed. And habits, if you don't come into them with maybe an intentional game plan, you'll just kind of be lost to them in a sense.
This is the worst habit. And to the point where this may sound dramatic, but I've been saying this more and more publicly. I believe that the cell phone has become our generation's form of cigarettes.
Huh. Yeah. As you say that, it makes a lot of sense. And noticing for me, a lot of my work has to be done on a cell phone, but I find myself, I'll be doing, a couple of, 30, 40 minutes, an hour of work on the cell phone. But then, when I go on my social media, updating my business account, next thing you know, I'm just kind of looking and looking. 30, 40 minutes has gone by, and I'm like, that wasn't productive at all.
Exactly. And to the point where Apple has actually come up with a pretty cool feature called screen time.
Okay.
Where you can go in your general settings, look at screen time, and find out how much productive or unproductive time.
Yeah. I just noticed that for the first time the other day.
On average, the athletes that I polled, and I've polled hundreds and thousands of athletes, on average, 4 hours a day of screen time. Just on their phone alone.
Okay.
Which means that, if we do a bell-shaped curve, we've got lots of people spending 5-6 hours a day on their phone. Now, if you do the same bell-shaped curve, if the average is 6.5 hours of sleep, that means we have a lot of people sleeping 5 hours, 4 hours. So overlap those two bell-shaped curves. And what we're saying is that there are a lot of athletes today who are literally logging more hours of phone time than they are hours of sleep a day.
That's crazy.
It's the reality.
So ultimately, basically to answer that question, if that can fix up, if we can find habits to really undoing those habits, that can be a huge benefit in getting an athlete to another level of their capacity.
It's a significant game changer for those athletes who are really serious.
Yeah.
But I can't express to you enough how many times I've looked very dedicated, committed athletes in the eye and said to them, if you do this one thing, it's going to change everything. And they look at me and say, I can't.
Huh.
Or I didn't. I mean, I tried, but I'm still lying in bed every night with my cell phone.
Yeah.
And they just have. That's why I said it's more powerful than cigarettes.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
Because now it's stealing your sleep. It's not just affecting your health.
Which is stealing away the body's ability to recover.
Yeah.
And muscle regrowth, muscle repair.
Yeah.
It's
even motor learning, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Delta 1, Delta 2 sleep, our light sleep is where things get encoded in the hippocampus, long-term, short-term memory. So we're seeing people have frustration with academic challenges.
Yeah.
And they're not rebounding from injuries well enough. And they're feeling depressed because they're looking at everyone's fake, wonderful, perfect life right before they fall asleep, including their ex-boyfriend or girlfriend.
Yeah.
Fake. And they feel... So, therefore, we have got to break this bad habit. Mm. But the addiction to this is far more profound than we realize.
It's very potent. Huh.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's pretty big words right there. So I'm going to start to take this more seriously myself. Just a couple additional points to that on my own thoughts was like, I know I'm as a trainer, I notice, you know, for me, a lot of times nutrition, the habit of nutrition, and people can know and they want so badly to lose weight.
Yes.
And the nutritional side, they're like, I just can't do it. It seems like it can kind of tie into this cell phone thing where people are struggling and scraping to find strategies to...
Interestingly, the entire field of psychology right now is really focused on the gut.
Huh.
That what we know is that what we eat impacts how we feel.
Yeah.
And we know that people generally are not feeling good. They're feeling anxious and depressed. And we know that a big part of that is the social media. We know that a big part of it is the sleep. But we also know that we can feel better if we eat better.
Ah.
But we also know that if we are well rested, we're going to make better choices. We're going to have better self-concept. We're going to be able to discern what to eat and what not to eat, better food prep. When we're sleep deprived, we naturally crave sugar and fat.
It's kind of like a stress, like you're just trying to get something to feel comfort with, in a sense.
Literally, if we want to solve the obesity problem in America, which is pretty rampant, we've got to go back to solving sleep.
Huh.
But if we solve sleep, we've got to solve cell phone addiction.
Yeah.
That you see the roots keep going.
Wow, down. That's pretty, that's very enlightening. I never thought that that would tie in.
Yes.
I knew the importance of sleep. Yes. I did not know that cell phones were a main cause of that.
That is it.
But that's very, very interesting. Another thing I was going to mention was I noticed for myself, just because as a quick aside, I had a slow beginning of June, so I didn't have to wake up as early for my clients. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, I had so much energy. I was like, where is this coming from?
Yes.
And I realized, oh, wait, I'm getting an extra hour and a half of sleep.
Right? times 7 days a week.
Yeah.
And suddenly you got an entire extra night.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
In the week. Right? And so if we do the math similarly, when we say like, if somebody's spending 4 hours a day on their cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's 28 hours a week, okay?
Yep.
28 hours a week. It actually comes out to be our calendar year.
Wow.
So 2 months of that calendar year, we're on our phones, and yet most people will say, I'm so tired. Mm. I don't have enough time.
Yep.
I'm overextended. But if you're spending 28 hours a week...
Yeah.
Which is pretty much not, like, not all that's productive.
Even if we just
cut it back to, like, under 2 hours a day, I mean, like, that would be much more reasonable.
Exactly, yeah.
But therein lies, the root cause.
Yeah, very, very interesting stuff. I'm going to start to shift gears now. I want to talk about, and you know what? As you said that, it seems like it ties into my next question with adults, your everyday workers.
Yeah.
What's maybe cell phone and sleep aside, what's maybe another thing that's a huge struggle for that population, the adult, the non-athlete in a sense?
Sure. So the non-athlete adult population, what's a major struggle for them?
Yeah.
The biggest struggle is this. if we look at our people that are maybe, you know, 25, 35, 45, maybe 55.
Yeah. Right?
Okay. Especially as we get a little bit older, 55, 65. They have had unbelievable work ethic.
Mm, yeah, to get to the point where they're at.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they learned it from the people that went ahead of them, people that are 85, 75. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Great Depression, great work ethic, all that came out of it. Okay. So what we see in our workplace is people have very, very good work ethic.
Mm.
I'm going to sound a little critical and say not really the millennials,
yeah,
right?
Fair enough.
Okay.
Fair enough.
That's a big criticism of the work ethic.
That's one of the biggest.
I'll circle back to that in just a second. But what we know is this. For the first time in human history, Generation X, for example, baby boomers, have the work ethic of the past, but they've met a technology that they can no longer keep up with.
Hmm. Okay.
So no matter how many emails you return, you're never, ever going to be caught up on your emails. You just can't keep up. And no matter how hard you work, you're never off because you're going to get a text even on vacation in Florida.
Yeah.
So we can no longer keep up with the technology. For every email you send, you get 1.4 back. If you do the math, like, you just can't.
Yep.
So we have an entire workforce of people that are burnt out.
Hmm.
Emotionally depleted because there is no rest and recovery like the generations of the past where they'd say, I'm home for the weekend, I'm off, I'm away on vacation,
yep,
I'll pick this back up. They're unable to do that. And what's interesting about the millennials, so the Generation X will criticize millennials and say, you guys are lazy.
Yeah.
But the millennials will say, look, you guys are miserable and overworked, and we don't want to be anything like you.
Yeah.
Touche. Good point.
You got a clashing going on. Yeah.
Right. But they've always grown up with the technology.
Yeah.
So they're managing it more.
Ah.
And so therein lies the biggest problem in the workplace.
Huh. That's very interesting. Touching on that, because I feel like I am sandwiched between the two, the Generation X and the millennials.
Yes.
I'm kind of in that, like, I struggle with the technology a little bit, but I have a pretty good handle of it.
Yep.
But I also saw my parents worked really hard, and I kind of work really hard. There's that burnout going on.
Yes.
With that burnout, what is a strategy for those adults to kind of – is it just going offline and setting boundaries? Is there more to it? Give me some strategies for how they can kind of get out of this burnout status.
The biggest strategy is this. In every house in America, there needs to be a family charging station in the master bedroom across the bedroom from the phone, from the bed.
Yeah. Ah.
And every night, according to Dr. Nicholas Hall, there's a yawn that we'll all experience that's the brain's start of the release of melatonin.
Okay.
And exactly 1 hour after that is when you would ideally fall asleep.
Okay.
So in every house, let's pick a time. So for me, I usually fall asleep around 10 o'clock-ish. So 9 o'clock-ish, all electronics, we're done. I'm done.
Yep.
And we put them on a family charging station and we get them away from the bed so that everyone can let the brain's release of melatonin do its thing.
Yeah.
And that we could fall asleep without feeding ourselves all this negative junk, we go to bed. And so the most practical solution for those that are feeling burnout is we've got to get more emotional rest and recharge. So one, family charging station. Two, at 9 o'clock-ish, we're done.
Yeah.
And all the phones are over there.
No laptop.
No. And if you have to, like, you can program, like, you know, your parents' or your 17-year-old daughter's who's out on a date's phone number to ring so you can get it.
Yeah.
So they'll come through. But everything else, is we shut it down. We buy an alarm clock. So no more phone as my alarm clock.
That's where I made my mistake.
Right? Most people do. We actually have an alarm clock.
Yeah.
And then lastly, we buy a book that we're actually going to read for pleasure.
Okay.
Most people say, well, as soon as I start reading a book, I fall asleep.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay.
That's what you want.
That was my biggest struggle. Every time I read a book, I'm falling asleep.
Then we get another hour a day.
Yeah.
7 days a week. That's another hour a week, a full night's sleep a week. That's the game changer.
That is huge. It seems like this is a way bigger issue. Because like, as trainers, sure, we're like, okay, you need to get sleep. Yeah, you need to get... But it's very kind of like, you know, yeah, okay.
Sure.
Work on that sleep thing. Okay, let's talk about this.
Right.
But you're saying, no, it's not a secondary thing. We need to start here, and that's got to be... Where everything kind of is the crux of everything, in a sense.
It really is.
Yeah.
It really is where everything in mental health has gone.
Ah, it's really interesting. And now I want to talk about kind of a little bit about the gut you mentioned.
Sure? Yes.
Is there anything you want to throw in addition to about the gut that you mentioned prior? Maybe... what are some strategies? You said everything in mental health right now is kind of coming out of the gut.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, the most abused drug in America is actually sugar.
Okay. Huh.
Some might not think of sugar as really a drug, but when you really break it down, it really is. And sugar is... a huge problem with our youth and obesity and nutrition. And so when we think about the gut and we think about addiction, we think about, well, we first got to break this addiction to sugar.
Yes.
It's really problematic for diabetes, for example. And we know that when you have diabetes, increased correlation with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so our mood is also impacted by the sugar as well.
Huh.
You know, we have the sugar crash, you know, you're not you when you're hungry, so eat a Snickers. Yes. Great. Let's just do more of the up and down insulin, right?
Yep.
Right. And so like, this is where we've got it wrong. Mm. And we've got to rethink sugar because it's hidden in so much of what we consume.
Yeah.
That's one example of how this is impacting our insulin, our blood sugar, and that's strictly tied to whether we're irritable, cranky, moody, energetic, sleepy.
So this is a thing that was, see, I think I'm about to throw my wife under the bus, but that's all right. Hopefully she doesn't listen.
She'll forgive you later.
She'll forgive me later. Before I was married, I took sugar out of my, I didn't even really eat much sugar at all.
Sure.
And, I noticed when I was an athlete, which was probably a good thing. And then as soon as I got married, she had a sweet tooth that she can really cook very well and bake very well. And the sugar started coming in. And obviously the stresses of life started to come in because now I was a married adult.
Yes.
But in addition to that, I noticed that everything's, you know, energy specifically started to really drop down.
Yeah. Well, in true confessions here, I married a woman who's an amazing baker as well.
Yeah.
Like you as the athlete, very strict with the sugar.
Yeah.
And I love to eat what she bakes.
Yeah, exactly.
So our wives are the same way there. But the truth is, like, we can't eat like athletes forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not realistic, practical for us to... So like Socrates said, all things in moderation.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so it's not about... getting rid of sugar from the diet.
Yeah, the cold turkeying.
Right. Yeah. But it's like anything. We want to be mindful.
Yep.
And the volume and the quality.
Yeah.
And as we age, also how that impacts us as well.
Yeah, very true. I want to take another turn now.
Sure, let's
I want to get a little bit scientific here.
Yep.
So... what's happening? I was listening to one of your interviews and you kind of touched a little bit on what happens, why a young athlete can't handle certain stresses that an adult athlete might be able to handle.
Yeah.
What's happening first biologically? Sure. And then second, what's the psychological side of that?
Sure. I'll go to the psychological first, which is this. We have put these kids into pressure cookers like we've never seen before. Mm. And yet we've never developed the psychological skills within them to manage that pressure cooker.
Okay.
So let me say it to you this way. my generation, Generation X, has wrecked youth sports in America. Something that was so good is now so absurd. And if you don't believe me, just come with me to any Little League game this weekend and you tell me what you see on the sidelines with the parents.
Fair enough. Right? Yeah, that's true.
It's out of control.
Yeah.
And so if we're going to put this kind of emotional pressure on these kids, we at least have to give them the skills to manage it. But mental health has not been well funded all through America. And the stigma is still out there, yeah, particularly in the sports world. It hasn't fallen completely yet. So therefore, we've got an entire generation of young people, expect them to just thrive.
Yep.
But at the
get same, over themselves and just do it.
Yes. Yeah. But suck it up is good, but like you need more than that.
Yeah.
And yet we've not taught them anxiety management.
Okay.
Emotional regulation skills. We've not taught them the science of sleep.
Yeah.
You know, if we actually give them the education, the skills, that's why I created that book, Mind of the Athlete, Clear Mind, Better Performance, is because it's loaded with like under concepts and techniques. So we have to literally give the athlete the skills to manage the pressure cooker that we expect them to thrive in.
Yeah. It seems like I mentioned, I believe earlier, where I said I struggled as a young athlete.
Yes.
And looking back at it, you said the correct word right there, anxiety.
Yes.
I would go to a pickup game on a basketball court and drop 30 points.
Yes.
And then I would go into a gym and I would freeze and be I couldn't be play. I wasn't playable.
Yeah. Yes. And it's because of the adults.
Huh.
It's, you know, when you're just kids on the court playing in the pickup, we have fun and
yeah,
it's awesome and great. But as soon as we turn the lights on bright and have the coach on the sidelines.
Yeah, she's like, you got to get this play.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep, there it is. And so that's not to say all the coaching is bad,
no,
but it is to say that, look, there's a lot of bad coaching out there. And, you know, their hearts are well-intended.
Yeah.
But if they never developed within their athletes the skills to manage that pressure, then mm-hmm, they've set them up for failure.
Failure. It seems like a good analogy for me. I kind of deal more with corrective exercise and getting people out of pain and also function at a high level.
Right.
It seems like whenever you throw and assume somebody is just perfectly efficient and you throw them into burpees and you throw them into these things without giving them the strategies to work on efficiency of movement, you're asking them to fail. And it seems like the same thing with an athlete.
Well said.
Yeah.
Very well said.
It's funny kind of how all these things kind of intertwine together in a sense there.
So really what it's come down to today in my field of sports psychology, it's really focused on two things. As a licensed psychologist, let me just clarify. There are a lot of people in the field of sports psychology that don't have a license.
Okay.
And so I'm a little bit biased, but I think that a doctorate level licensed psychologist or master's level way to go.
Yeah.
And the NCAA has actually validated that and said that, you know, there's four guidelines for mental health. And number one is we only want people with a license.
Ah, okay.
You know, because
they're setting a standard.
Yeah. Like, I mean, a lot of people say, hey, I do mental skills coaching and, you know, but there's no license. There's no oversight. You know, that part of it, I think, is very mental health is so significant today that
we really got to. Yeah, there's so much knowledge to be had there that you're kind of putting yourself at a disadvantage.
Yes.
To just kind of not have that knowledge base, that rich knowledge base.
Which is really, you know, when you say there's two sides of the coin, it's that one side is mental health, and we've got to put licensed professionals out there to deal with the intense emotional health of our athletes today.
Yeah.
And that's the feel good, let's help people part of it. Now, the other part of this is the high performance sports psychology, which is like, look, man, this is a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
So with the people I serve, right, if we know that, you know, the average person is getting 6.5 hours of sleep and struggling with anxiety, if we could actually give them the skills to improve their sleep, have less anxiety, you know, better muscle repair, muscle recovery, memory consolidation, now which athlete, all things being equal, is going to have the competitive advantage.
Oh, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's where when I work with a lot of athletes, I love giving them that competitive advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. It them against the same type of athlete is going to win each time. Yeah. Now, what is, I'll kind of end it here where I want to talk about what would you do? What do you say to a person who they, I mean, I deal with this all the time where no matter how much you're trying to help them help themselves, they can't take that step. They, it seems like they really want it, but do they want it? What's a strategy we can use as trainers, a strategy that you can use as a coach to kind of get them to urge in these, the things you talked about, sleep, cell phone usage, sugar.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing, but I'm really a fan of visualization.
Okay.
And so really having that, like, let's just close your eyes. Like before we actually do this, like, let's just close your eyes and I want to walk you through and I want you to see yourself doing this in your mind's eye.
Yeah.
That what happens is in order for us to do things that maybe we haven't done, the mind needs a point of reference. And we're very visual. So if we can actually create a visual image in our mind of us doing this and succeeding at this, then when we actually go to do it, the mind can't tell what's real and what's imagined. So it's like, oh, yeah, I've got this memory of, of me doing it because we just intentionally created it.
Ah.
So therefore, somebody doing physical therapy, rehabbing, trying a new exercise, bench pressing for a max, we can get them to have more success by visually creating the images in their mind of them already doing that, which they eventually will.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I know visualization, I had one day the Philadelphia Eagles, he's like their human performance coach or whatever, come and do a talk for our trainers.
Yes.
And he was talking about a lot of visualization techniques and stuff that they use for the athletes. But does that kind of correlate well with, like, let's say somebody has a habit of negative talk.
Yes.
Could that be a reason why they haven't made the habit change?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That we have a conversation with ourselves all the time.
Yeah.
And negative self-talk is something that we maybe have internalized, certain voices and messages and wording from other people along the journey.
Yeah.
So when we visualize with somebody, it's very important for us to guide that visualization with positive self-talk, such as saying to ourselves, I got this.
Yeah.
I got this. I got this.
Yeah.
Because if they can override the negative voice in their head, they're going to have more success.
Yeah.
But too often there's been a lot of damage done from other people along our journeys that we've got to get over or through that negative self-talk.
So, yeah. And then that's where you can kind of come in. Absolutely. And then now you have some of those clinical skills to get
absolutely
them out of that. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's more complicated than it seems.
Yeah. It's like everything, there's a simplicity, a basicness to it.
Yes.
But it can get pretty complex quickly.
Pretty quick.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm a little biased again, but I think that we, you know, if we have the chance to work with doctoral level sports psychologists that with licensure, I think then, you know, it's a big deal.
It's, yeah, it could be a game changer. It's just that another, like you just mentioned, it's another level up. If you're competing against the same type of athlete, and now you have somebody who has a doctorate.
Yes.
They might be able to navigate you through that extra thing or have another thing here. I don't know anything. Yeah. So,
well, you know, obviously I'm biased. Human body so much, and physiology is something I just love to study. But I think the only thing more complicated than the human body is the human mind.
Yeah. It's so funny you said that, because I was just training a client this morning and we were talking about this. I listened to this other podcast and these guys are talking way over my head in human movement and correctives. I'm like, what's going on here?
Yes.
And then at the end of the podcast, they're like, yeah, you know what? We barely know anything about the human body. And I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, it's kind of like the mind where we even know less. Yeah. And it was funny that you said that.
Yeah. Well, you get it. And obviously you understand how important that connection between the mind and the body is.
Yeah. It's, I'm learning. I wish I knew more, you know, but I feel like this is a realm as I train more. I feel like the more knowledge, you know, the more you realize how important the brain is to everything you do.
Yes. Yes.
It's crucial. And seeing people, like, I don't know if you know Goggins, he's that.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And like seeing what somebody like that could put their body through, where I know, well, I probably might be able to put my body through that, but the mental side of it is crucial to that.
Absolutely.
And finding those strategies. Yeah.
Yeah. Hence the point, you know, we've got to work on developing the skills necessary for the pressure cookers that we all find ourselves in.
Yeah.
Whether it's parenthood or whether it's trying to be more effective in our job or role.
Yep.
Or maybe it's competing as an athlete. We have all got to work on the mental side of our games.
Yep. Very, very true. Well, that ends kind of my questioning. I there's probably 100 other things we can talk about, but I'll maybe down the road set up another interview.
This would be great.
Yeah. So thank you so much. And it was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much, guys, for taking time out of your day to listen to this podcast and to kind of go on a journey with me to learn more about human health, specifically here in the psychology of the mind. I look forward to having another one with him and talking to Dr. Jared Spencer again. And also on deck, we have a couple cool ones coming up in the next couple weeks. So keep your eyes open and looking out for those things. Thank you again. This is Soul Center Fitness Podcast, Stephen Slack, over and out.